Good morning, this is AM. I'm Chris Yuleman. On the program today, calls for a royal commission into dodgy financial advice and a weak corporate watchdog. I'll speak with Finance Minister Matthias Cormann. Is the enemy of my enemy my friend? Syria comes to the aid of Iraq. And World Cup fever is catching. America discovers a new game called soccer.
We could not be prouder of them. They are defying the odds and earn a lot of believers in the process. And I want everybody on the team to know that all of us back home are really proud of.
First this morning, fraud. Forgery, a financial planning scam at Australia's biggest bank that cost consumers millions, and a timid corporate watchdog that failed to act. These are some of the charges a powerful Senate committee has levelled against the Commonwealth Bank and the Australian Securities and Investment Commission that have led it to call for a royal commission into the scandal. It also found the regulator did not pay sufficient attention to whistleblowers. One of them, Sydney lawyer James Wheeldon, told Deborah Cornwell nothing short of a royal commission is warranted.
You've got two of the biggest, most important institutions in Australia, the securities regulator, which is responsible for protecting consumers, and then the Commonwealth Bank, one of the big four banks, engaged in really reprehensible conduct. And I think the Australian people deserve to know what's going on in this. I absolutely think that, you know, the sunlight should be poured on.
This finding from the Senate committee seems to be suggesting a shocking kind of failure to take up the cudgels for consumers, even when they were aware there were some really serious problems at the Commonwealth Bank.
Well, I was shocked and disbelieving of what I saw when I was working at ASIC.
What were you shocked by especially?
I was shocked by the venality, the incompetence, the laziness, the lack of intellectual rigour, just the inability to satisfy basic legal obligations that people had as members of the Australian Public Service.
Well, the Commonwealth Bank says it rejects the committee's accusations, and we've asked the bank and ASIC for an interview so far without success. Matthias Cormann is the Finance Minister. Matthias Cormann, will you consider a call for a royal commission?
The report was tabled late yesterday afternoon. It goes over more than 500 pages and has 61 recommendations. I've started reading it last night. I will carefully consider it. And when I've worked my way through it, we'll make a full response. I might just say that the recommendation for a royal commission was not a unanimous recommendation. Senator Bushby, the chair of the Senate Economics Legislation Committee, dissented from that recommendation, and he did make a very persuasive argument that yet another inquiry might not be the best way forward.
But he was the only one who did dissent.
Well, he is the chair of the Senate Economics Legislation Committee. He is a very senior senator that has, of course, been involved in these sorts of inquiries for a long time.
Can customers have confidence in the Commonwealth Bank's assurances that the culture there has changed when, according to the committee, one of the financial planners has been promoted?
Well, I mean, I let the Commonwealth Bank respond for itself. What I would say is that...
Unfortunately, it won't at the moment beyond just putting out a release.
Well, that's a matter for the Commonwealth Bank. What I would say is that the events that the committee investigated were events that took place in the past, incidentally, over the period of the previous government. Since then, a lot has changed. The industry has worked very hard to lift professional, ethical and educational standards. There's more work to be done on that front, and we're certainly very keen to keep working with organisations like the Financial Planning Association, the AFA and SPI and others in relation to that. And also, of course, regulatory arrangements have changed. There is now a statutory requirement for financial advisors to act in the best interest of their clients, a requirement that we are keeping, of course, and there is a ban on conflicted remuneration, a ban that we're keeping as well.
But one of the things the committee found was that accusations were covered up. The bank itself only put up its lawyer before the committee. The management hasn't actually appeared before it. So can the bank be trusted to heal itself?
Well, I've seen those observations, and they are very concerning observations, and I do look forward to an explanation from the bank in relation to these matters.
Will you be meeting with them?
Well, I've had conversations with the senior leadership at the CBI in relation to some of these matters over the past week, and I'm certainly, once I've properly studied the report, I would expect that I would have some further conversations.
But really, can the bank just saying there's nothing to see here be taken at face value?
Well, I do think that the bank needs to provide a proper response to the allegations that have been raised.
To the watchdog, why did it take 16 months for ASIC to respond to a tip-off?
Well, I mean, you know, ASIC, of course, has come out and has acknowledged that they got this, some of these things wrong, and they've certainly got to lift their game. I would just say that there is right now a financial systems inquiry underway, which also includes, as part of its scope, a review into the role of ASIC. And once that inquiry responds, the government, once that inquiry reports, the government will be making some announcements on the way forward.
Are you satisfied with the culture at ASIC, given one of the whistleblowers has said it was a very complacent culture, and in fact the inquiry found that the organisation itself was timid?
Well, Greg Medcraft certainly has said that he has, learned from, the experiences of this inquiry. He's provided a response to say that ASIC is, using the recommendations in this report to continue to lift their performance, and that, of course, as the independent regulator in this space, that is what we would expect them to do.
Does it have the resources and the powers that it needs?
We believe it does, but of course, as I've indicated, there is a financial system inquiry currently underway, which is, of course, as part of its scope, reviewing the role of ASIC. There are a range of recommendations in the Senate Economics Committee report, which we are studying very carefully in relation to ASIC, and once we've worked our way through all of that, we'll provide a proper and considered response.
Isn't what we see in this case the classic problem of a commissions-based culture, that these people working for themselves and not their clients? Shouldn't your changes to financial planning laws have come after this report?
Well, what you've just raised actually continues to be the case. I mean, conflicted remuneration has been banned, commissions have been banned, and they continue to be banned after the changes that we're proposing to financial advice laws. I mean, we were broadly aware of the issues that had been raised in this inquiry. There had been, of course, many submissions and many public hearings. The changes that we're proposing to financial advice laws in no way interfere with what is required in order to ensure that these sorts of events don't happen again.
And the laws that you propose will cover bank employees?
Indeed they do. What we have announced last Friday is that bank employees providing general advice leading to product sales cannot receive either an upfront or trailing commission for that sort of advice.
On another matter, it would now seem that the government will get its repeal of emissions trading through the Senate with the help of the Palmer United Party. Are you confident the new Senate will finish the job in a couple of weeks?
Well, we have absolutely welcomed Clive Palmer's announcement that he will support our efforts to scrap the carbon tax. That is very good news indeed.
But you will have your hands tied on scrapping the Clean Energy Finance Corporation?
Well, let's see how that works itself through the Senate. Certainly, Mr. Palmer has announced that he won't be supporting that particular proposition. But from our point of view, we don't think it's appropriate to continue to borrow billions and billions of dollars in order to underwrite a bank that is competing with the private sector.
Mr. Palmer does seem to change his mind from day to day and week to week. Are you sure that this deal will hold?
I'm very confident that Mr. Palmer and the Palmer United Party senators will support our efforts to scrap the carbon tax, which is very good news for Australia. I mean, like the party that has been completely inconsistent and been chopping and changing in relation to budget measures are the Greens. A few weeks ago, they were fully supportive of our proposal to ensure that taxes on fuel keep pace with inflation. And of course, today the Greens are telling us that they want taxes on fuel to continue to go down and down and down every year in real terms over the forward estimates.
Matthias Coleman, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
Always good to talk to you.
And Matthias Coleman is, of course, the Finance Minister. You're listening to AM, where it's coming up to 10 past 8. And ahead, we're off to the World Cup, where one of the world's most famous footballers is banned for the next 9 internationals for biting. And we'll track the progress of a rising Australian tennis star. Is my enemy's enemy my friend? That, no doubt, is a question being asked in Washington at the moment as the Sunni insurgency in Iraq forges deeply ironic alliances. The pariah state of Syria has launched airstrikes inside Iraq, and that's been welcomed by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Iran is also supplying arms and advice, and one of the militias that fought against the United States after its 2003 invasion is reforming. Middle East correspondent Matt Brown is in Baghdad. Matt, what can you tell us about these airstrikes?
Well, these airstrikes happened some time ago now in Abu Kamal, which is a border post between Iraq and Syria. Not only were extremist Sunni insurgents hit, but also there were allegations that some civilians were hit. Today, the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki told the BBC that those airstrikes did take place and that they were Syrian jets responsible for those airstrikes. Now, most of the reporting has been that the bombs landed in Iraqi territory. Nouri al-Maliki says that they were on the Syrian side of the border. But the important thing is he's welcomed them and said that any airstrike against ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the Sunni extremist insurgents, is welcome.
So what does this tell us about the way this conflict is developing?
Well, for a long time now, the insurgents have been rubbing out the borders established here for around 100 years. Now we're seeing the armed forces of the different states doing that too. Let's take on board what Nouri al-Maliki has said, that the Syrians bombed their side of the border. And I've been up there in years gone by. It is very clear it's a town with a border running through it. It is clear which side of the line you might be on. But most of the reporting is that that airstrike was on the Iraqi side. And perhaps for reasons of national pride, he doesn't want to acknowledge that. You're also seeing the Iranians coming in and playing a significant role. They've played a very strong role supporting Nouri al-Maliki's government. And now American advisers coming in to Baghdad yet again, quite possibly supporting their own airstrikes. So people, nations that are in effect sworn enemies, the United States, the Iranians, and also their allies, the Syrians, all fighting together against this al-Qaeda offshoot, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria.
And the Mehdi Army, which so famously fought against the Americans in Iraq, has been reformed, renamed, and its leaders had something to say.
That's right. Muqtada al-Sadr was famous after the 2003 American-led invasion for fighting the Americans, and his Mehdi Army, now rebranded the Peace Battalion, is mobilising, ready to fight the Sunni insurgents. But a very interesting comment from him today, Chris. He's a rival of the Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He's a political rival. And today he said, one, we will make the ground shake under the Sunni insurgents. That's to be expected. But two, he said that the Sunni community had been discriminated against and marginalised, which is really interesting because at this moment, all of the players are jockeying for power. There's been an election. Mr al-Maliki is effectively a caretaker prime minister. He needs to stitch together a government. He hasn't done that. Look at what's happened. He's lost control of the north of the country. And here's Muqtada al-Sadr, not a secular guy, making these comments, giving some sort of a fillip to the Sunni community. And maybe it augurs well for an end to some of the gross sectarianism, but maybe it's just a play, and maybe it foreshadows more conflict between these two parts of the Shiite community. Something to watch very closely, this man Muqtada al-Sadr, what his militia does and what he says about the Sunni community.
Matt Brown in Baghdad. The extent and depravity of British entertainer Jimmy Savile's sexual crimes is becoming alarmingly clear with the release of a new report into his activities in hospitals. It was already established the now-dead radio and TV star was a serial offender, with more than 500 people coming forward saying he abused them. Europe correspondent Philip Williams reports from London, and a warning, some might find parts of this report disturbing.
It was the sheer audacity that shocked many. An opportunist predator, he often groomed his victims, including a patient at Leeds Infirmary called Jane.
I felt like I was the chosen one. Absolutely the chosen one. And even to the point where I was taken down to the room, I still felt like the chosen one.
Having gained the trust of the then young girl, she was lured down to a room in the basement of the hospital.
You try and analyse and think, well, could I have done anything differently to stop it? And to this day, all these years later, I really don't think I could have done it. It was just, I was kind of like part of a process, I think.
The reason Jimmy Savile was in the hospital unsupervised was because he raised millions for them in charity campaigns and was seen as a publicity asset. He even had the keys to several hospitals and flats set aside for him, and the free run to commit his crimes against children as young as 5, up to 75, men, women and children. Some attacked as they lay on trolleys after operations. There were even suggestions he interfered with the dead in the hospital mortuaries. Dr. Sue Proctor led the investigation at Leeds Hospital.
The organisation was starstruck about Jimmy Savile and failed over a period of 50 years to ever question why he was there or find out his motivation or understand him better.
Jimmy Savile was a frequent visitor at Broadmoor Psychiatric Hospital, where again he had free rein and a set of keys. The report said he would watch women shower, molest and rape patients and staff. Liz Dux is a lawyer with Slater and Gordon.
He was absolutely shameless, and I cannot accept that not one person could have challenged him and brought him to task, and many victims spared.
The government has responded with an apology, this from the Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt.
We let them down badly, and however long ago it may have been, many of them are still reliving the pain they went through. If we cannot undo the past, I hope that honesty and transparency about what happened can at least alleviate some of the suffering.
There is much more to come. This is just one of many Savile inquiries. Still to report, educational institutions, where he was also a regular visitor, and the BBC, where he was a star attraction over 5 decades. The common question, how did he get away with it all his life? This is Philip Williams in London, reporting for AM.
And London-based writer Evie Wilde says she's shocked and surprised to win the Miles Franklin Award. She picked up the $60,000 prize for her work, All the Birds Singing, which judges described as a beautifully crafted and unforgettable novel. Lindy Kerin reports.
The country's most coveted literary award was announced at a ceremony in Sydney last night.
I'm delighted to announce the 2014 Miles Franklin Literary Award is awarded to Evie Wilde for her novel, All the Birds Singing.
The London-based writer was clearly thrilled.
I can't tell if it's my heart or my fetus kicking. It's a lot going on here.
Evie Wilde joins a long list of celebrated authors. This year she pipped Richard Flanagan, Alexis Wright and 4-time winner Tim Winton.
Oh, it's amazing. The Miles Franklin is really the only literary award that I've ever followed properly. Partly, I think, because when I first read Tim Winton and I looked up about him, about Cloud Street, and realised he'd won it so many times, I just knew they were onto a good thing. And there's so many of my heroes who've won it in the past.
And so what does it mean to you now to be the Miles Franklin Award winner for 2014?
It almost seems like a bit of a joke. And I shouldn't say that. My publicist is probably a bit worried, but it doesn't seem at all real. It just is amazing.
Evie Wilde started writing short stories when she was 16 and published her first novel 4 years ago. All the Birds Singing has already won a swag of awards.
It's about a woman called Jake who's living on a small island in the UK with a few sheep that she looks after, and something's killing her sheep in the night. And then it goes back to her past in Australia and her life as a sheep shearer. And then it goes backwards in time to find out what the dark thing is that's sort of followed her over and what she's running from.
Evie Wilde was born in London to an Australian mother and English father. She says a lot of her writing has been inspired by her mother's homesickness for Australia.
She lives in London. She left Australia when she was 21, meaning to leave for a year, and met my father and stayed in London. And there was always this strange balance of her missing Australia but loving her home in London. So, yeah, she passed that on to me, and that's why I write about Australia, really.
The 34-year-old has begun working on her next novel. She'll return to her independent bookstore in southeast London.
I will be at the till on Wednesday, and I'm having a baby in December. So yeah, it's all mad.
A massive year.
Yeah, it's a really, really big one.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
A big year indeed. Evie Wilde, the Miles Franklin Award winner, speaking to Lindy Caron. It was the foul seen around the world. Uruguayan soccer player Luis Suarez has been given the biggest ban in World Cup history for biting an Italian opponent. He's been ruled out of the next 9 internationals and banned from all soccer activity for 4 months. It means Uruguay will be without their star player for the knockout stage of the World Cup in Brazil. Football authorities in Uruguay say they will appeal. Louise Creeley reports.
It was a bite that outraged football fans.
Luis Suarez appeared to move his head, and he might have bit him as well.
Now FIFA has moved swiftly against rogue Uruguayan striker Luis Suarez. He's been slapped with a 4-month ban from football and is out for 9 international matches for biting an opponent at the World Cup in Brazil. He's also been fined almost $120,000. FIFA spokeswoman Delia Fischer.
The player Luis Suarez is banned from taking part in any kind of football-related activity. The player Luis Suarez is prohibited from entering the confines of any stadium during the period of the ban.
This is the third time that the striker has been found guilty of biting a fellow player, and the governing body has taken strong action, despite Uruguay's insistence that the accusation wasn't proved. But the disciplinary committee pushed to set an example of Suarez.
And here a quote from the chairman of the FIFA disciplinary committee, Claudio Sulzer. Such behaviour cannot be tolerated on any football pitch, and in particular not at the FIFA World Cup, when the eyes of millions of people are on the stars on the field.
The biting took place 10 minutes before the end of Uruguay's 1-0 win over Italy earlier this week. Fans from Uruguay have raged against the decision to kick out their star player.
It's terrible. It's truly a total injustice. One game would be reasonable, but it's totally arbitrary.
Uruguay has to leave. We have to leave. We have to be strong. They can't do this to us. What about the others? What about Neymar's elbow hit?
And Liverpool fans are also waiting to see what the decision means for their team, with the South American star part of their key Premier League lineup.
They haven't been shown any photos, have they, of the fella's shoulder? Just, you know, last time there was a sort of full set of teeth marks. This looks like it was his top teeth just coming down. But he just seems to have this little bit of madness in him.
Meanwhile, many Uruguayan fans remain defiant, saying their team will overcome Suarez's sidelining.
They are looking for fair play. They'll have fair play. I think that Uruguay, with the players it has, it won't stop. We will get there. We'll get there anyway.
The football authorities in Uruguay say they will appeal the decision.
Louise Creeley. The World Cup is clearly winning converts. America is now excited about soccer. The game has found a new fan base in a country where gridiron, baseball and basketball rule. The US is now through to the next round in Brazil, despite losing 1-0 to Germany this morning. But no matter what the final result, some are predicting this World Cup will be a defining moment for US soccer. North America correspondent Lisa Miller reports.
The game between the US and Germany kicked off at noon on a weekday, but that didn't stop thousands of people watching the match on big screens in a public park.
I feel like US isn't really known for soccer, and since now people are saying that we have a chance to actually make it and beat Germany and get past, maybe eliminate Portugal, people maybe have more pride. And I think a lot of people here are out in their work clothes. I think they're on their lunch break.
What are you thinking of the game so far?
A very decent game.
What brought you along here today? Why have you come along to watch with the crowd?
To support our heroes, the US team.
The scene was repeated across the US as Americans left their desks and clocked off work for a couple of hours to watch the game. It was estimated that kind of dedication could cost US employers about $390 million in lost productivity. Even the president was photographed watching on board Air Force One on his way to an event in Minnesota.
We could not be prouder of them. They are defying the odds and earn a lot of believers in the process. And I want everybody on the team to know that all of us back home are really proud of them.
If anyone was predicting trouble from the boss, they could produce a letter written by the US head coach and sent out on social media asking employers to excuse them from work.
Once every 4 years, you got to support America. So,
are you always a fan of soccer?
Yeah, for a long time. My family's from overseas, so soccer's a big sport for us.
But it hasn't been for the rest of America.
Demographics are shifting in the United States. More kids are playing soccer than any other sport, so more people are going to get into the game.
So you've skipped out work today?
No comment.
The US team has been more competitive than anyone expected, and it's showing in the TV ratings. 25 million people watched the last US game. That's more than the basketball finals, even the World Series baseball, although it's well short of a Super Bowl viewership. While youth soccer has been popular in the US for years, the adult version of the game has never really taken off. This World Cup could be the start of something. The test will be if the world's superpower still cares about the game when their team bows out. This is Lisa Miller in Washington for AM.
Once upon a time, Australian hopes burned bright each June as Wimbledon rolled around. That now seems a distant memory, but there was a flicker from a new light overnight. A 19-year-old produced the performance of the tournament so far as Nick Kyrgios saved an extraordinary 9 match points on the way to beating the 13th seed in the second round. And the eternal question has been raised again. Is he the star Australian tennis so badly needs? Steve Pearce is courtside for the ABC and filed this report.
It was an incredible win and one which tennis in Australia had been craving. The top brass at Tennis Australia has long been trumpeting the next generation of players as being truly world class. The pride and relief was palpable as the head of tennis, Todd Woodbridge, spoke after Kyrgios's stunning win.
What can it do for the sport in Australia?
I think what it actually says is that the last 7-8 years of development are working. You know, people have wanted the next star overnight. It just doesn't happen that way. Nick has come through our program all the way.
Bernard Tomic was for many years the poster boy of what the future could hold for the sport in Australia. But that image may now change to the young man from Canberra who has everyone's attention. John Newcombe won 3 singles titles at Wimbledon. He thinks Kyrgios can go far.
How do you produce shots like that in that sort of pressure situation as a 19-year-old?
You know, he's got some big guns in his game, but he's also got the X factor that he's able to, you know, keep his nerve under pressure and he believes in himself. When you come out and win a match like that at Wimbledon, you're making an announcement to the tennis world that he's a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, if he keeps going like that, it won't be long before he's in the top 50, and then we'll see how he goes, if he can get down on the top 20 and the top 10.
It's high praise, and Newcombe is not alone with his thoughts on how far this new star can go and the effect he could have. Wally Mazur made the 4th round here 3 times and now commentates for pay television. He says Kyrgios could soon be hot property in the tennis world.
He's good for the game because he's pretty lively. He seems to engage with the crowd really well. And I would imagine that tournament directors around the world are sort of looking at this guy going, I want him in my event.
It's a role Kyrgios sees as his responsibility to embrace for the sport and the paying public.
You just got to refuse to play bad out there for the crowd. I think you got to find your best tennis sometimes, and you know, that's what I did today, and I think the crowd enjoyed it a lot. You know, I played some unbelievable tennis today, and you know, he was coming up with some really good shots as well. You know, I think I saved 9 match points, so there's plenty of opportunities that he could have taken. So, you know, I just came out on top and I'm just really happy.
His feet may be firmly on the ground at the moment, but keep winning and in the same style, and it may be more than just Tennis Australia and its former greats that see him as a future star. This is Steve Pearce at Wimbledon for AM.
And on the financial markets, some disappointing economic data has weighed on US stocks. Despite a soaring opening appearance from the video camera maker GoPro, its shares rose 32% above the initial public offering price. But consumer spending rose just 0.2% in May after a flat April. In New York, the Dow Jones has closed at 16,846 points. That is down 21 points. The Nasdaq has closed at 4,379. That is down 1 point. The dollar is buying 94.12 US cents, and that is steady. And that is AM for Friday. AM's executive producer is Brendan Trembath. The associate producer is Ashley Hall. Political producer, Michelle Ainsworth. Technical production by Kem White and Jeremy Conroy. Web production by Mariella Attard and Jackie Booth. Production coordination by Elise Denman. Saturday AM with Elizabeth Jackson will be along tomorrow at the usual time. So I'm Chris Yulman. I'll be back again on Monday. Have a great weekend. Stay tuned to ABC Local Radio. It's 8:30.